Let's have an AA meeting. All right. My name is Chris Wirt. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. I welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org desperately in need will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And tonight, as a young lady coming up to speak who I've seen around for a long time now, she was very young when she came in, and she's managed to stick around. That's inspiring to see young people come in and stay. And I'm really looking forward. I've never heard her story before, so I'm really looking forward to it too. So with that, I'll give you Emmy.
Hey everybody, I'm Emmy and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much for inviting me to come here this evening. It really is such an honor to be able to share my story. I've been thinking about this a lot since I was asked to share my story, and I was thinking, you know, maybe I should make an outline of things I should say. I've shared my story for the full hour many times before, but something about this time or just how I've changed, I want to be like very specific and make an outline and make sure I hit certain points. But I think that's a little bit overkill. So I'm just going to share what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now to the best of my ability. As it was mentioned, my sobriety date is October 3rd, 2008, so it's been about 7.5 years. It was just a few months before I turned 21 that I was in AA, and my home group is the Skyline group. I mostly go on Fridays. It's just around the corner, and I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. So what it was like, it's hard for me to convey what things were like and how severe they were, because seeing me today, and this is something my different sponsees have said to me, is that I can't believe that you were ever that person. So sometimes I feel like I need proof of people that saw me with like one day sober, because that really was me. And with my childhood, I experienced an extreme amount of complex trauma that I didn't even understand was trauma until I turned, actually until sobriety. I heard people say they have PTSD, and I thought of, you know, veterans and other types of things with PTSD, but it wasn't until about halfway through my sobriety so far that I understood that was a part of my story in AA and a part of what that I can't separate out from my alcoholism. So I'm actually from Atlanta, in the city of Atlanta. I grew up in Buckhead, and my dad is a successful business executive at a company headquartered here in Atlanta. I grew up on West Paces Ferry. I went to the best, you know, elementary schools. I went to a very elite private school. But that wasn't really my life. I mean, those were things that you could see on paper. But what I experienced was very different. My grandparents on my mom's side are both have severe alcohol problems. My uncle on my mom's side died when he was 42 from this disease. I was kind of half raised by my grandparents, and so being around active alcoholism with the violence that's a part of that, the fights, the fear, just a lot of violence, a lot of denial, a lot of it's okay, if you say you're sorry the next morning type of thing. I really believed that for a long time, that you can be as abusive or as violent as you want to be, you know, if you've had a few drinks, and then as long as you say you're sorry in the morning and you really mean it, it's okay. That's another thing that I didn't understand. I was modeling in my romantic relationships, even into sobriety. So the things I've learned in sobriety are very powerful lessons. that I didn't even realize were in me until getting sober. So I was around that, and as a result, my mom had immense struggles. You could classify them as mental illness. I see it as a combination of mental illness and recovering from alcoholism, because what I've learned in the program is that you don't have to be an alcoholic to suffer from alcoholism. So with my mom, she wasn't present at all. There were a lot of very strong mood swings, a lot of rages, a lot of just being completely mentally checked out. My father wasn't really a husband. He was kind of more like a caretaker for my mom. Went to work. Work was his outlet during the day. And as long as my sister and I, kind of combed our hair and went to school and ate food and went to sleep, that was it. So explaining that I grew up in neglect with all of the things on paper seems really contradictory. And that's why I didn't understand what I had experienced for a long time or why I started to feel the way I felt around middle school. So getting to middle school, I don't want to take up too much time on what it was like. Something really big happened in my life. A lot of things happened. There was violence, there was instability. What I remember the most was silence, of just coming home and, being there without a lot of input from my parents. And I know today a lot of people joke about, like, helicopter parents and saying that, kids are spoiled and millennials, but this was kind of different. I was bullied at school. I was actually beaten up when I was 5 by an older kid. My parents knew I didn't do anything. I had a teacher that had, drug issues, and all the other kids got all the other parents got their kids out of that class, but I wasn't. So there were just things that, other parents would rise up with like a pitchfork and say, like, our child's not going to go through this. But in my case, it was like, whatever. And so I experienced a lot of really dangerous things outside of the home as well. So with all of this and just not having the language to process emotions or to say, I feel completely alone and there's no warmth in my life and I need warmth and human connection in my family when I come home, I didn't really know how to articulate that when I was 13. So I started to really act out. I became extremely depressed, and I did a lot of things for attention. And that sounds really belittling. It's true, I did it for attention. I needed attention. I started to threaten to commit suicide. I developed a severe eating disorder. I started gravitating towards older kids that were just really in a not a good mix. So each time I threatened suicide, I was sent to Ridgeview Institute when I was 13. So after about the third time of being sent to Ridgeview when I was 13, there's something called an educational consultant, and I'm going to try to be objective in telling my story, but they're educational consultants, and my parents went to one, and they suggested that I go to a facility in Utah. So when I was 13, I was discharged from Ridgeview. I didn't understand. It's like, oh, wow, I'm getting discharged. You get to go home. Surprise. But at 6 a.m. the next day, my parents woke me up. They said, you're going to Utah. And then I was in an 8-week long intensive wilderness program when I was 13. A lot of these programs since have been shut down because of things that happened there to kids, and I won't share their details because they're very upsetting, but as an example, I wasn't allowed to talk for my first 3 weeks. We pushed like oxen carts through the desert in Utah to hike as a part of a therapy program. I remember drinking water out of a cow pond, and it was, like, green even after I filtered it. A girl that was in my group dropped a boulder on her foot to try to break it to go home. So I thought after 8 weeks that I was going to get to go home. But it turned out that 8 week period was like an assessment period to make recommendation of the level of care that was appropriate for me. And I was 13. I was the youngest out of everyone there. The average age, I would say, was like 15 at least. And the recommendation was to send me to a place that was a lockdown residential facility, that is modeled after prisons. And with the routines and the roll call and the layout of the units, we like in a pod structure, and it utilized a form of behavioral modification called a radical confrontation and brutal honesty and what they call a positive peer culture, which is they go to extreme measures to modify your behavior. And a lot of the tactics are, for some people, I suppose they work. In my case, you don't really have a choice if you want to modify your behavior or not. It's very confrontational. You'll have privileges removed. Again, like my first 3 weeks, I was put on isolation from the group, so I couldn't talk to people. I had to sit in my room. My meals were brought to me. I had to write down everything I said I wanted to say before I said it, so it's pretty much like written communication and radical confrontation. And that really did a lot of damage to me, especially because I was the youngest there. And after my year there, I went to another place that was less strict, but it was still along those lines. A lot of the staff were the same. It was just in a different location in Utah. So I thought, okay, this is a step down. I'll be there for a few months. So I do another year at this other place, and the year rolls around, and then my parents say, okay, you're going to spend another year here. So from when I was, my prime teenage years of being 13, 14, 15, 16, I was locked away in a facility with these very intense methods of interacting. I survived by building a 10-foot double barricaded wall around me. Because I was the youngest, I was the smallest, I was the most bullied and the most scapegoated, basically, until I learned how to scare people to not mess with me. So I became very detached. I stopped connecting to people. The staff members, we'd have a different staff member every 2 days. There would be different girls in my unit every 6 months. On top of that, we had to switch rooms and move rooms every 4 to 6 weeks. So I even if I wanted to connect to people, even if I felt like it was safe to connect to people, just logistically, I couldn't really have that connection. So after it was over, I came back and I went straight to public high school in the suburbs. And when I was at public high school, I was so ashamed of what I had been through. I knew it wasn't normal, but I felt so ashamed. And I had no idea how to really make friends. I don't know if you'd call it the normal way, like the lighthearted, like, I'm 16, we go to high school way. And it was all new, and these were kids that had been in, the suburb, and I had been around, 15-year-olds that were in gangs with the Crips in Sacramento, or, drug running in Manhattan when they were, like, 14. So I'm like, I don't really know what to talk to you about. But I knew that I made a decision that, and this was the precursor for alcohol for me. After going through that experience, I thought everything was about me getting an Ivy League education so I could have control, so I could become an investment banker so I can make a lot of money and never have to be controlled by anyone again or sent somewhere I didn't want to go. So instead of having alcohol, I had this thing that every part of my life was centered around, and I became completely obsessive about performance in school. And essentially, I only had 2 years of real high school, so I had to catch up with all these kids. And I did that, and I made it into the top three colleges in the United States. And I graduated, and I completed a very rigorous diploma program. But the funny thing is that after I had that acceptance, that was my moment of, I've arrived. But then I had no idea how I was going to be okay. So the second I obtained that thing that I thought would make me whole, non-spiritual solution, an external solution to complete chaos inside of me that I couldn't really put words to, I started drinking. And it was a high school party, my senior year. I thought, okay, I've gotten into school. I can do whatever I want now. But what do I really want to do? Like, I didn't know who I was without this goal of getting into a school. I didn't know what my values were. I hated myself because I had been sent to this crazy program. Like, clearly I'm defective in some way. And when I was indicating that I needed attention, the response was to send me away and to keep me there. So I just didn't know how to cope with anything. So I started drinking. The first time it was, I want to experience being drunk right away. And then immediately at that same party, I started doing things that I was so ashamed of. Just completely. I woke up the next day thinking, I can't believe I really did that. What are people going to think of me? And that was my first drink. And it didn't stop. I continued to drink. The summer before college, it started to progress immediately. In addition to drinking, I tried other things I never thought I would do. Alcohol was my gateway. And once I found some other things along that gateway that took away all of the edge that I felt, all of the like profound insecurity I felt about my past, about who I am, where I come from, I never wanted to stop. I felt like this is what I've been missing my whole life. I can enjoy being around people. Like, just enjoy talking to people. Like, I don't enjoy talking to people. Even now, I just feel really awkward. But that went away where I could feel like, oh, this is why people want to socialize. This is why people like parties. This is how people connect to each other. That's why they enjoy it. I just never wanted to stop. So I went to school, and then it was just everything progressed so rapidly. I got in trouble for... I started to binge drink. I could not control how much I drank. My life started to spiral out of control. I mean, completely. Even as, like a 19 or 20-year-old in college, I got involved in some really, really dark corners of society and with just some really dark people that were also sick and suffering. I continued to black out. I mean, I had severe blackouts. My friends went from people that had lives other than just drinking to only people that would contact me if they wanted something. I started trying other things. And I don't want to make it like a war story of drinking, but I had alcohol poisoning that was severe to the point that I had internal bleeding. And I said, I'm definitely not going to do that again. But I did. And I was doing other stuff within like 4 days. Everything I'd worked for with that opportunity, I lost it. I couldn't function. I couldn't do schoolwork. I did not know how to connect to other people in a positive way. On top of that, I had an internship in New York City, in Manhattan, so there's a great place for a budding alcoholic, is being in Manhattan when you're 19 and don't have any friends or family there. So I just really got involved in a dark part of society. I won't go too much into that, but it was something I never thought I would experience. Like, my normal was not normal. All I wanted to do was go to clubs and be this, like, party girl, and I thought that was really me. But what I didn't understand is that alcoholism is so powerful that I had convinced myself that those were activities I really enjoyed. Like, I really enjoyed going out to the clubs. I really enjoyed this social scene, but I didn't enjoy it at all. I mean, the disease is so cunning, baffling, and powerful that I had convinced myself that these hobbies or activities were really something I enjoyed, when it's clear, if you looked at me and observed me, I did not enjoy it at all. Like, I was not smiling, I was not happy, but I still believed that that's what I wanted. So somehow, miraculously, I made it through my sophomore year. I think I withdrew from a few courses. I passed some courses, but I just started to fall apart. I became extremely suicidal, to the point where I was in Boston and there was a commuter rail. I would look up the times that the commuter rail would come through in the morning when it was still dark and debate, am I going to walk to the train tracks this morning or not? And I looked up AA in that town. But I didn't go. But I looked it up, and I knew it was there. But I thought it was too far of a walk. So I came back to Atlanta just because I was completely helpless. I couldn't put anything together. And that was as long as my parents had seen me for, I think, like more than 5 days at a time. And so I just started to go nuts because I didn't have my connections. It wasn't my environment, you know, with my lifestyle, with, you know, my regular habits of how I was getting alcohol and how I was relaxing. And I was not a lovely creature. I mean, at the time I had like a full mohawk. I was just terror. I mean, I would scream at people. I was very violent. I was not someone you would want to approach. And my parents experienced the brunt of that. They convinced me to start this thing called DBT, Dialectical Behavioral Therapy. And there was a group therapy aspect, and it required I go to therapy and work with a psychiatrist. And I always knew that if you said you wanted to harm yourself, you would be forced to go to, like, 72 hours of observation. So I never said anything. I never said anything that would suggest that, because I knew I would be sent to rehab and I would be sent back to Ridgeview, which is where I was sent away for 3 years of my life. I hated the idea of going back to Ridgeview or any place for behavioral health after what happened to me. I was so resistant. I was so angry. I did not want to get sober at all. I didn't even think that drinking was the problem. I thought it's that I couldn't manage my life better. But I just let it slip. I mean, it got to the point where I really knew I was about to kill myself. And that did scare me. And I did say something. And then I was really pissed off. Because I was forced to go on a 1013 back to Ridgeview. And I mean, I was like so angry, because all I could remember was that was where 3 years of my life that destroyed me started. I didn't want to be sober. I did not care. I just wanted to do my 72 hours and get out. I had a job waiting tables. I was planning to stay at a motel month, you know, week to week, continue waiting tables, and then just figure out on my own. And I told my admitting doctor that I was going to leave. I said, I'm just going to go. Like, my 72 hours are up. I'm done here. like, this is it. And my parents basically said, okay, if you come back here, your stuff is going to be in boxes and you'll take a cab to get here. And I was like, oh, that's kind of annoying. Like, this was my logic. I was like, I don't want to deal with my packed boxes and cab. I think I'll just stay. So I stayed. It's like, it's just ridiculous. I was so angry, yet so lazy, that it actually got me sober, being that lazy. Maybe we have our defects for a reason, to get to a certain point. But, you know, I stayed, and I didn't want to get sober. Nobody on the rehab unit would have named me as most likely to stay sober. I mean, I was kicking and screaming. I was, you know, passing notes and meeting boys during the AA meetings in the disgusting hospital bathrooms. I just had no desire at all. But I knew I was exhausted, basically from a 10-year march of being sent away when I was 13 to fighting every single day of my life after that. And I just surrendered. It's that simple. I was in a meeting on a Wednesday night. The topic was reservations. And I had been praying, kind of, you know, praying-ish, because I thought it was silly. And I just was able to be honest. I was able to say and raise my hand that I still have everything I was using and drinking at my parents' house, and I was planning on keeping it for a rainy day. I mean, I believed in my mind that if I just, you know, once every Saturday after work, if it's like a slow day, it's not a problem if I want to like drink every once in a while. But for some reason, I shared that with the group, and after that moment of honesty, everything else worked for me. My number one resentment was against my parents for what I went through, from the neglect, from the very traumatic things I experienced at those facilities that have now been legally shut down. Later, I found out that the director of this facility was banned from practicing therapy in New Jersey because of the damage of the methods and the controversy of the methods and the results of what happened to the youth in this program that he ran. So we went out to Utah to open a facility there, which is when I was there. But it was finally shut down in 2015. And it was Rosh Hashanah. I'm Jewish. And that's the Jewish New Year. And on the Jewish New Year, you set your resolution, and I said, God, please help me forgive my parents. And I thought there was no way that's going to happen. I mean, I have every single reason to hate my parents, to just want to destroy them, and I didn't think it would work. I was like, you know, Rosh Hashanah, resolutions. But I stayed sober, and I got a sponsor finally. I actually called her. She said, anything I put before my sobriety, I'll lose. And in my mind, I still thought that I can't lose this Ivy League education that I've worked for. I could take up to 2 years off on a leave of absence from school. And I was like, I'm going to go back next semester. Like, I'm going to go back. My life will be okay if I go back to school. Like, it was so fundamental to my identity. Like drinking. It was just a part of me. It's just what I did. It's how I experienced life. And she said, whatever you put before your sobriety, you're going to lose. It was true. Had I gone back to school in Boston, I would have, boom, didn't stand a chance. But I was like, oh, I don't want to do that. But I sat on it. I said, okay, I think that's a stupid idea. I do not like it at all. I'll consider it. I kept praying for God to help me be honest. You know, the principle behind the first step. I went into a sober living place. I got a job. And slowly things started to work. I mean, I went to Skyland. My sober living place was on Peachtree. And I went to the beginner's meeting at Skyland, and I just felt like I can be myself here, I can be honest, and I'm not going to be judged. It's a safe place, and people care about me here. So I kept going there, kept going to meetings. I did the steps. I actually did my third step prayer here in that hallway at NABA, like in the stairwell by the sewage, because there was no other place. I got on my knees with my sponsor and did the third step prayer in that random hallway. And my first sponsor actually did 3 years in prison. Mine wasn't prison, but it was basically prison. It was like psychotherapy prison. And she had done 3 years in prison and worked her steps behind the bars with her sponsor via the mail. So it was really God providing me with that gift of a sponsor who, like, in the beginning, because of how I had to survive, I didn't really respond well to empathy. Like, I perceived emotions as weakness, and I was way too scared to connect with a person through weakness. It had to be through this, like, strength. And she had that, too. And so I was like, all right, I'll listen to her. Okay, you want to do that? So it's like we had this kind of, like, way of bonding that worked, that was how I was able to connect with people at the time, and she could relate to me at that level. Because I just didn't get it. I didn't understand crying. I didn't understand hugging. I didn't really do bonding that well. And I went through all 12 steps with her. I did my first 4 step, and I sat underneath a tree at a park after doing that 4 step. And then I did my 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th steps. And before I knew it, it was another year. And it was Rosh Hashanah, and I had forgiven my parents. And then I thought, whoa, this actually works. Because I had tried so hard, and I had known intellectually, okay, to be a healthy, functional person, you know, you wake up at this time every day, you take a shower, you go to work, you make these kinds of decisions. This is a rational perspective. Therefore, I should believe it. But that doesn't work. Like, I'm an alcoholic. That does not work for me. So having a spiritual solution that truly removed those problems for me was so humbling, because I had basically, everything before getting sober had been, I've got to survive. I'm going to do this. I can't rely on other people. I'm going to make it happen to protect myself and survive. So seeing a spiritual solution work in my life, and that freedom from being able to forgive, just opened a whole new place in me. I kept going to meetings. I got a home group. It was the International Conference of Young People in AA at 7 months in sobriety. And so I got to see all of these young people from all over the world that are sober. And I just thought, I can do this. I can really be young and stay sober. It's not going to be as bad as I thought it was. I thought my life was over forever. I really did. I seriously thought my life was over forever, and this was the worst thing that could ever happen to me. But I was okay with that, because I was done. I was so close to death for so long, with so little human connection, that I was like, even if my life is over and this is it, I can do that in these rooms. But it wasn't like that at all. I mean, there were young people doing cool stuff that I enjoyed being around that also didn't drink. I started sponsoring women, and that opened a whole new level of being able to see my own character defects in action, and really held me accountable to practicing my own program if I'm going to recommend it to somebody else. I always, always, always had a service position. And things were really good. I mean, I went back to school. I transferred to Emory. I graduated from college. I did a study abroad program in China, in Beijing, and I went to AA meetings in Beijing. And it was the coolest thing ever. And I got to So there was a rave on the Great Wall of China. And I really wanted to go to this rave. I mean, there was like, what is that guy? DJ Slim or something from the 90s. And there was like a full moon and this DJ from the 90s and the Great Wall of China, and there was a rave. And I'm like 23. I'm like, I've got to go. And then this guy at the AA meeting in Beijing said, "Hey, Emmy, could you share your story on this Saturday night?" And I'm like, "Yes, I can." And so I shared my story, and I stayed sober. And at that meeting, I mean, that is the extent of my transformation. I mean, I was the person in rehab that was... no one would have said Emmy's going to stay sober. It was the exact opposite. And all of a sudden, I'm in Beijing, like 5 years later. There's this incredible rave on the Great Wall. I mean, I don't know who would turn that down. And I'm sharing my story in an AA meeting, and I'm happy. I'm like, this is the best place I can be right now. So I graduated from school. I got a job. I got like a corporate job. And that was a rough adjustment. It was pretty rough. I stuck it out. I've actually been with the same company for 4 years, and I've been promoted. And before, I mean, I didn't do anything for 4 years. I mean, I went to one elementary school, then I went to one middle school, then I went to the Utah place, and then I went to public high school, and then I went to college in Boston, and then I went to college in Emory. So doing anything for 4 years is different, and I've been able to cope. I haven't done it perfectly, but I mean, I'm able to support myself financially. I'm able to have a good life. I'm able to go to AA, and there are some things I want to touch on that hit at about like, I think 5.5, 6 years between like years six. Around 6 years in sobriety, I was kind of through with AA. I was kind of like, meetings, they're all the same. I'm sick of it. It's boring. I don't want to do service work. You know, just having a case of the screw-its for like several months in a row. I didn't really have a sponsor. I kept my service positions, but I wasn't really there. I got into a very abusive relationship, very abusive romantic relationship. And I can honestly say that if I had not had a service position and had I not made those deposits in the bank in my earlier sobriety where people knew my face and they said, "Hey, Emmy, how are you doing? Like, we haven't seen you in a while. Like, Emmy, where are you? Like, come to this meeting," or like, "Where are you? You've got to make coffee." Had I not had those friendships or connections in the rooms, or still dragged myself to meetings every once in a while, like every 2 weeks, and shown up to kind of do service work, I would have been a complete goner. And I mean, I consider it as a period where I was not emotionally sober. I wanted to be willing, but it just wasn't there. And for whatever reason, I had to get this out of my system. I don't know. Maybe that's my justification. I got to a point in that relationship where I was done. And I gave it up. I moved to be away from the source, from this person. Stopped, you know, dropped him cold turkey. Got a sponsor. Went back into the steps all the way. And I just finished a rigorous 4-step where I really have a new level of honesty, and I can see what was driving that out of control behavior. And I stayed sober physically, but I can say it was a very, very, very powerful lesson that I'm unbelievably grateful. It didn't require me picking up a drink to learn. But if I'm a dry drunk, I'm just as dangerous as when I'm drinking. And I hadn't experienced in sobriety that feeling of wanting to be willing, but just not having the willingness to cut out these toxic behaviors. So it was very humbling. and I don't want to say, I mean, I'm kind of glad it happened. It's like, we don't regret to shut the door on it, but it really taught me things about myself that maybe I wouldn't have learned otherwise. And again, on Rosh Hashanah, it's like every time my forsuk comes up, it's the new year. I asked God to grant me sanity in my romantic relationships, because I kept gravitating towards these really toxic, really dysfunctional, unhealthy, by every definition. Like, you would see me with the person I was dating and be like, yeah, that's not spiritual. Like, I don't even need to be your sponsor to tell you that's not spiritual, type of thing. But I kept going there over and over and over again. And it's like, you know, the jaywalker. You cross the street so many times and you're going to get hit. And so it's like, I kept losing these things, but I kept my sobriety because of God, honestly. And the previous willingness I had to show my face. But I don't want to get back to that place again. And I did finish my fourth step. And it's given me, again, this openness to fully be who I can be without the ego of, you know, what can I achieve today? Who can I get to say I'm great today? Who can I date today that I think is, like cool enough to make me feel okay about myself? You know, what's, like, the most cutting-edge job I could have to make me feel okay inside? So having that stripped away each day and being back to a place of, this is the best place I can be. You know, take the material possessions, take the job, the career, the income, the whatever. When the rooms of AA are the place that I'm the happiest, then life is good overall. Thank you all for letting me share.
All right. Thank you so much, Amy. I appreciate that. Although the circumstances of our lives can be quite different, I can relate to what happened when she drank and what happened when God took direction of her life. So thank you so much. Okay. I have asked Frank Waters to come give out the chips.
Anonymity, huh?
I'm Frank Waters, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. I said that anyway. Here in Napa and other places, we have a chip system here. Some places it's marble, some places, you know, it's whatever it is, key tags. And the thing is, if you want to try this way of living one day at a time or half a day at a time, you come up here and we give you one of these chips. And you hold on to it, put it in your pocket, and rub all the little ridges off of it, things like that. So if you want to try this and give it a shot, you come up here and get this white chip. Anybody want to try it tonight?
All right.